Hello, and welcome to New Books in Sports. I'm your host, Bruce Berglund. Each week, we choose an interesting new book on some area of sports, and we interview the author. On this week's episode, my guest is sociologist Peter Millward of Durham University. We are discussing his book, The Global Football League, Transnational Networks, Social Movements, and Sport in the New Media Age, published in 2011 by Palgrave Macmillan as part of their series Global Culture and Sport. The English Premier League is in the midst of its 20th season. Since its founding in 1992, the EPL has become not only the biggest money-making league in European football, but also one of the most popular and most valuable brands in all of global sports. But the success of the EPL has not come without turmoil, nor without dissent. Many fans, who see themselves as die-hard followers of the league's clubs, have responded angrily to rising ticket prices, the arrival of phony, affluent fans, and the apparent threat of foreign owners. As Pete explains in his book and our interview, the changes in the EPL have led supporters of some clubs to organize protest movements and even to form breakaway teams that, in their view, preserve the traditions of English football. In last week's episode of the podcast, philosopher Stephen Mumford described how sports fans actually feel themselves to be a part of the clubs they support. This week, a sociologist gives us proof of this. The fans that Pete researched didn't see their team as an external object of allegiance. Instead, they saw themselves as the club. And in the case studies he discusses, some supporters come to the determination that they, and not the players on the field or the management, were the true representatives of the team's character. This is a book about sports fans, about the local supporters who grow up with a club, and how they then respond when that club becomes a global brand with millions of consumers. Pete writes with the careful attention of a scholar and the sensibility of a fan. In the interest of scholarly self-disclosure, we start the interview by clarifying just where Pete's fan allegiance lies.
Oh, well, I follow a small team called Wigan Athletic, a proud follower of many years, a season ticket holder, and one of the few bums on seats you might actually see there if you get the highlights over in the States.
So were you drawn to study sociology by your interest in football?
No. I studied sociology as an undergraduate, then as a postgraduate, and then as I was beginning my PhD was around issues around Europeanization, okay. Cultural identities, Europeanization, xenophobia, racism. And I just thought that football and sport was a really good prism through which I could actually view these issues. And so it proved. My PhD was on the Europeanization of English football and how that finds resonance in fan attitudes and fan cultures too.
So football has provided a rich supply of subjects for you. You've published research on a range of topics related to football.
I think so, yes. Ranging from fan cultures, fan attitudes, hooliganism, institutional structures, financial issues, a number of issues, I think, yeah.
So your current book that we're talking about, The Global Football League, is about specifically the English Premier League. And in picking up on the definite article in the title, I'll ask you, what makes the EPL the Global Football League in comparison to other European leagues?
Well, underscoring all of this, I think, is actually the media coverage that the English Premier League receives and how that is larger than any of its comparator leagues. And really, its comparator football leagues are the other big four European leagues, so in France, in Germany, in Italy and in Spain. And I mean, to give you an example, the English Premier League, I think, is broadcast to 211 countries across the world, which outranks any of the others. So I think that's the underscoring point that makes it really the global football league. And connected to this, of course, with these with such television interest, there are television revenues which promote interest from fans, interest from prospective investors. Provides revenues which attract players from across the world, and all of these added together, I think, makes the English Premier League, more so than any of its other comparators, the global football league.
So your book begins with the formation of the Premier League 20 years ago. So can you tell us how the Premier League began, and how can its origins be viewed in this larger context of globalization?
Yeah, well, the Premier League really began, I suppose, out of a need to rebrand football in England. I mean, from many, many years, there's been a gradual decline in live match attendances. That decline was slightly reversed for a couple of years around 1966, where England won the World Cup. But the decline was relatively steep from the post-war years through to about 1990. So there was a need to rebrand football, to repackage it, to make it look appealing to new fans. I think England's relative success, getting to the semi-finals of the 1990 World Cup, showed many of those directors within football that there was a thirst there amongst supporters to watch football. It was widely viewed. It was a success. And so I think that just really kind of drove home that point. And from there, what the new directors, the directors at that time, sought to do was to try and monetize a potential new fan base. And a way of doing this was through establishing the new Premier League, or the Premiership as it was then, and screening that on television. Sky played a huge part. Sky came along, and Sky became real, I guess, what we could call marketing partners for the Premier League.
So were these directors from the start, were they aiming for a global audience or bringing back English fans to the game?
No, they were just aiming for an increased audience. Mm-hmm. At the first level, it was English fans, British fans, and pockets of overseas fans, which are long-standing in Ireland, in Scandinavia, etc., etc. It was really aimed at those. But, you know, I'm a sociologist, and one of the kind of Marxist ideas is that actually the market will always find its most lucrative space, its most lucrative level. And actually, through the huge success domestically in promoting the Premier League and tapping into these new markets, actually from about 10, 12 years ago, with the appointment of Richard Scudamore, actually many of the directors in the Premier League decided that the market could be much larger, could be global. So that kind of grew in the 10 years after the start of the Premier League and the 10 or 12 years that we've since had.
You include an interesting piece of evidence at the start in the chapter when you discuss the EPL's beginnings. And that's about the financial success or the financial standing of English clubs in the early 1990s. And you have a statement in the book that the largest club in Britain in 1992 in terms of revenue was Rangers, which
yes,
was twice the size financially of Manchester United, Liverpool, Arsenal, and yet Rangers' revenue was only a tenth of that of Milan. And when I read that is stunning, to be reminded that really the EPL began out of a position of weakness.
Yeah, it did. I mean, I think I borrow that evidence from Rogan Taylor's book, which was published in 1995, but really set around that sort of era. But yeah, it did. It was a. I mean, you've got to think of the position of English football in the late 80s and early 90s, where it was. Declining match attendances. It was popularly parallel to hooliganism. It really wasn't a very socially desirable use of leisure time, if you like. Mm-hmm. So it did. It began with that position of of weakness, and grew from there. I mean, what Rogan Taylor says in that particular quote you refer to is now a million miles away from where we are at this moment in time.
Mm-hmm. So you also talk about the clubs of the Premier League as brands
yeah.
that have global customers. And yeah. So in light of the club's meager revenues in the early 1990s, how is it that they became global brands?
Well, it's an incremental growth, isn't it? There are gradual steps along the way. I think Manchester United winning the European Cup Winners' Cup in the early 90s was a first step whereby Manchester United and English football was repackaged and regrown on the European level. I think Chelsea signing Ruud Gullit in the mid-90s was a massive step. Ruud Gullit, the Dutch player who was probably best known for playing for AC Milan. I think from there you get other overseas players following Gullit into the English league, increasingly more and more of the higher profile players. So there's an interest from players. I think connected to that you've got the tapping into more and bigger overseas markets of fans. I think you've got another massive step around the largest clubs like Liverpool and Manchester United beginning to tour the lucrative East Asia markets. I think there are various steps to where we get to now. I think there are multiple steps, and these steps have been fairly incremental.
So at the close of that chapter on the origins of the EPL, you make a statement that I found... I found it contradictory. So let me read the statement, then I'll ask you about it. You wrote, quote, "The EPL is globally sold and therefore exists in a transnational space because of its tradition and local environment. It is nothing more than its clubs, which are textured in their regional cultures, and without this, the product would not be sold." So can you expand on this, please? How is it that the global draw of Premier League teams is based upon their local fan base and traditions?
Well, locality and history and the way in which history and locality are bound together in this instance provides stories upon which Premier League clubs can be sold upon. So Sky can build these stories. Other broadcasters across the world can show and illustrate these stories. These stories are based around locality, the clubs being important, the history, the authenticity. They're based around these stories. They provide a rich source of detail. Also added to this, in the very contemporary era, there's something about place which is important in the selling of games to overseas markets too. The team I support, Wigan Athletic, would be far less appealing to many of the overseas broadcasters and the Liverpools and Manchester Uniteds of this world because the spectacle doesn't look as big. And it doesn't look as big because there are fewer people in the stadium. Mm-hmm. That sort of locality based around fans in the stadium is really important for this telling of the story too. So I think these clubs do belong in this transnational space, which is about money, about players, about overseas television markets, about overseas investment, about overseas profile. But that is crucially connected to the locality of the clubs too.
So it's not so much the attraction, is not so much the quality of the football as much it is the narrative that surrounds the clubs?
I think so. I think that's right. I think it's really about the way in which the story, the excitement gets sold rather than actually often quite mundane football matches.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So you mentioned that Wigan would not really draw as a global brand in the same way of Liverpool and Arsenal and Manchester United because... they don't have the crowds at matches, but what about other clubs that have larger grounds? Say, I'm trying to think off the top of my head, say Sunderland or West Ham. Why is it that they have not translated their traditions and their local fan support into becoming global brands?
It's a good question. I think there's something to do with success too.
Mm-hmm.
Fans want to follow successful teams. That happens on local, on national, on international scales.
So teams that had been successful in the past, you mean then?
Successful in the past is part of the story.
Yeah.
But recent successes in the age of the Premier League really important too. Mm-hmm. So, of course, you know, the Sunderlands and West Hams and Aston Villas of this world have proud histories of winning some trophies, you know, probably, well, certainly less so than Liverpool, Manchester United, Arsenal. But crucially, in the gaze of this global media, they've been far less successful. It's interesting that you talk about Sunderland as well, because Niall Quinn, who's, as you may know, former player at Sunderland, actually was the team manager for a couple of games as well, but most recently was chairman of the club, has been moved from that role into overseas operations director, I think his new title is, and his job is really to try and promote Sunderland as a global brand, use his name, use his kudos as that. But to return to the question most carefully, I think it's about how clubs are successful in the era of the Premier League, in the era of this media spotlight.
So what influence did the Champions League have in the global branding of Premier League clubs?
Well, the Champions League took that development that was going on nationally with the Premier League, the rise of the Premier League, onto a European scale. And what it really did was provide, I suppose you could say, certainly in the later parts of the tournament, the equivalent of that sort of interest that would build with the 39th game, in that you have super clubs, you know, European, global super clubs who would frequently play each other. The rise of the Premier League really reduced the chances of Nottingham Forest and Malmo getting to the final again, and increased the chances of the final being held between two of the seeded bigger clubs, Manchester United and Barcelona, for instance. And so what the Champions League did through its structure, allowing multiple teams from the top leagues to qualify, but also through its structures around being a league whereby one-off results were less important, certainly a league in the early stages of the tournament where one-off results were less important, increased the chances of the best teams going further. So it promoted them further on a European scale, on a global scale.
So with the global marketing, or the new marketing of the Premier League, this has brought a change in the match day experience. Clubs have installed luxury boxes, theater seats, big screens at the grounds. And there's been a process of what you call in the book sanitization of the football experience. So can you explain what that involves?
Yeah, I mean, this really refers to some of the more traditional fans and their views around this. I mean, these traditional fans, the fans that are local to the club, the fans that their type of fan continue to go throughout the leaner periods of English football's history, they have this belief that they, like all fans actually in this case, but they have this belief that they culturally own the football club. The football club is theirs. And they go along to the football club, not just to see a team win, although that is really quite important, but they go along to the games to talk with friends, to hang out with family, to be part of an experience, a kind of working class weekend experience. And they argue that with the changes to the Premier League, and it's not just through Sky and through television coverage, but through this increased marketization, trying to extract ever-increasing profits from fans as customers. They believe that the clubs have become more interested in those supporters who have perhaps higher levels of disposable income, who will pay higher prices for tickets. And so they believe that the club market their policies toward those fans, which they believe has sanitized the match day experience.
So how do these traditional fans, what criteria do they use to mark themselves as authentic fans from these more affluent, as they call them, the Johnny-come-latelys?
Well, the criteria are really what we might call elastic cultural boundaries. You know, these criteria kind of exclude groups as well as including, and you have to really be part of the group to fully understand, but it's things like when it's appropriate to sing, what songs can be sung, the way they dress, the way they behave. And these fans can recognize each other. You know, these are, you know, communities bigger than actually knowing each other. They're somewhat imagined, but they do recognize each other and know that they're just part of the group by the way in which they present themselves.
So I was surprised to see that geography plays a large part in distinguishing who the authentic fan is, correct? That the fan who remains in Manchester, in Liverpool, is regarded as more authentic than the fan coming up from London, correct?
Of course, yeah. Certainly imagined geographies. Mm-hmm. For instance, there's a really interesting debate that goes on lots of the websites amongst the Liverpool fans about what it means to be a real Scouser. Scouser are people from Liverpool, mm-hmm. as opposed to a Wool. I would be a Wool, and in that Wools are those people who are from the towns that are in between Liverpool and Manchester. And it comes from the term that they give, woolly back, which refers to living out with the sheep, I think. I think that's what it means. I'm not sure. But the debate is, to be a real Scouser, you must have a purple bin. Now, bins, the wheelie bins, the bins, the garbage collections, are organised by the local council. And Liverpool City Council give out purple bins. So you must have a purple bin to be a real Scouser. Mm-hmm. It's interesting cultural politics, actually.
But it's not, the lines are not necessarily drawn according to wealth, correct? Because I was surprised when you talk about the opposition groups that emerge in Liverpool foreign ownership of the club. There are people in these opposition groups who consider themselves to be true Liverpool fans who have pretty good jobs that pay pretty well.
That's right. These opposition groups, I mean, like most new social movements, they're organized by those who are stoically middle class. But class money it's embroiled within this complex mix, I think. Mm-hmm. I mean, geography is really important, but just abiding by these traditional cultures, which were once very working class, is the key, actually. Masculine cultures are also important, masculinity. So I think we've got geography, we've got something of class, and we've got something of masculinity there. It's this kind of complex mix. It's not automatically reducible to one or the other.
Yeah, yeah. So in thinking as you're talking about it, can you see a common denominator?
Between?
With all of these different factors, all of these different criteria, do you see something at the base? Is it this shared nostalgia? Is it a longing for community? What is it that brings all these factors together in the drawing of lines between?
Oh, it's both of those. It's both a longing for community. It's a nostalgia for the way football used to be, mm-hmm. or the way they believed football used to be. Mm-hmm. Many of these supporters actually believe that in the past, the football club was completely reducible to the fans, that the chairman once supported fan interests, that the players were part of these communities. Actually, history and historical sources dispute this. Mm-hmm. But there's a longing for community and a nostalgia. And to be part of this group, what supporters have to do is really assimilate and take on board these values around what it means to be a real fan, and a real fan is one of these traditional fans in the eyes of the traditional fans themselves.
So does this longing for community outweigh the longing for wins and for success in the league table? As I was reading about these disgruntled fans, I was thinking, you know, did anybody on the fan sites step forward and say, you know, I don't like these affluent fans, I don't like these foreign owners, but I like that we win. I like that we bring in the top players from around the world. I like that we are in the chase for the league title and for cups every year. I like that we compete in the Champions League every year. And frankly, if not for these changes with the fan base, with the ownership, we wouldn't do that. Does the instinct for community outweigh this?
Well, again,
pride and success.
Well, the answer to this is fairly complex too, I think, in that we're seeing the makings of exactly what you talk about at Manchester City.
Mm-hmm.
Manchester City, a club where, 12 years ago, they were in the third tier. After, you know, they're a club who have spent almost all the history in the top division. Mm-hmm. But 10 years ago, they were in the third tier down. And they've been promoted back up. They haven't won a cup in God knows how many years up until last season. And their fans are exactly as you talk about at this moment in time. And I think that thirst for success is really very important. And I think it probably would have been oh so important at Manchester United too. It would have been in the early 90s when they too were success starved. But actually, after 20 years or so of success, that then becomes normalised. Mm-hmm. Because it becomes normalised and taken for granted, then there's a longing for more. And more, in this case, is a sense of ownership over a club.
Okay. A longing for more in a sense of something other than success in the table and Champions League and so forth.
That's right, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, success is important, but ownership of a club is important. But as I say, 20 years ago, those values might have been a little different.
Okay. Can I follow up on that? And I'll ask you a question that's directed more to you as a football fan than as a sociologist. As I was reading about this opposition among Manchester United fans, I was thinking, come on, you're Manchester United fans. In the context of American sports, it would be like Yankees fans or LA Lakers fans whining because their clubs are too rich and successful. Did you ever just kind of get frustrated with the complaints and the whining of these United fans?
No, I kind of understand it.
Yeah,
I kind of understand it on one level. I mean, they're just so used to being successful, and it's not actually being successful is always important to them. Being rich, the club being rich is quite interesting and quite important too, and it's quite contradictory, the relationship with the club's wealth, because on the one hand, they're really so proud that the club tops these wealth tables, you know, the Deloitte rich list of football clubs. Manchester United are always in the top two or three, and they're quite proud of that. It's something to use as a one-up, as a way of kind of beating the rivals of Liverpool or Manchester City. Our club's richer than yours, that type of thing. But at the same time, they feel that they've gradually been dislocated from what the club is,
yeah.
that increasingly they have been charged higher and higher ticket prices. As a result of this, their type of fans, the fan groups that they belong to, have stopped attending. People don't sing. I mean, it's really complex. I agree with what you're saying on one level, but I can also see their point from on the other hand too.
Yeah. Well, let me ask it to you personally. So as a Wigan fan, In looking at do you look at envy at, say, Manchester City, where you have this rich owner coming in, is going to spend loads of money to make a top club, or do you think, no thanks, I'm happy with what I have?
Well, the history of Wigan Athletic is that they only came into the Football League in 1978. Mm-hmm. And up until 2003, they'd never been out of the bottom two divisions. So in many cases, in many ways, many of the lower divisions fans would see Wigan Athletic as the successful model of the small club.
Yeah.
I've been spoilt. So, but life in the Premier League as a Wigan Athletic fan is sometimes boring. It's sometimes dull. We show up, we're playing Manchester City at home on Monday night. I hope Roberto Martinez isn't listening to this, our manager, but we're going to lose. We know we're going to lose. We show up to games and we know we're going to lose. And that can be quite dull at times. When the team know they're going to lose, the fans know they're going to lose, we don't stand a chance of winning. That can be quite dull. But that is to even be in the Premier League and to have been there for 7 years is a huge amount of success for a club of our size. Mm-hmm. You know, clubs about the same size of Wigan Athletic are in the bottom two divisions. They would see just being there as success, at least for a while. Mm-hmm. But that's become, being in the Premier League has normalised for us now. And it can be dull. It can be rubbish. Mm-hmm. If you were to offer me the chance of Manchester City's owners selling Manchester City and buying Wigan Athletic and bringing players like Tevez and Aguero and Balotelli and these type of players to Wigan Athletic, even though they get paid extortionate sums of money, I would say, yes, let's have it. I'll take that easy. But then if we had 20 years of that success, that would probably then become normalised. Yeah, and I'd want players who were successful and a bit more like me too.
Yeah. So bringing this in a new direction, so it's actually more appealing, more engaging for the fan to go up and down in the table rather than to be always near the bottom or always near the top.
Well, no fan would ever take a rubbish season of finishing lower than where they would expect. No fan would ever take that. But actually, when you look over a period of time, perhaps that's what gives the fan the enjoyment. That's why they enjoy successes, because they've had hard times too.
Yeah. I want to ask about overseas fans of the big clubs, of Manchester United, Liverpool. So do those people who consider themselves authentic fans, do they object to the boom of overseas supporters for their teams? Do they see fans in Asia or Africa as something good, as a nuisance, as a threat? How do they view overseas fans?
It's a mixture. Those local fans, those traditional fans, don't have a problem as long as the overseas supporters see the local fans, the traditional fans, as the real fans and aspire to be like them in their fan practices.
So
there's a dimension of assimilation there. In the book, I talk about, or I give evidence of SOS, Spirit of Shankly, the Liverpool fan group, and how they embrace, I think it's the New York Liverpool Football Supporters Club, as long as they assimilate to their codes of practice of what a real supporter is and look to learn from them. So on that level, it's about learning, it's about respecting the traditions of what they see as the club, but actually the traditions of the club are really the traditions of the traditional fan base. I think they see overseas markets as being potentially problematic when, and of course the overseas fans feed into this market, but they see the markets as being potentially problematic when the impact of that overseas market takes the club away from that fan base further too. So, for instance, an example would be around inconsistent kickoff times. Mm-hmm. So in England, the traditional kickoff commencement time for a match would be 3 p.m. on a Saturday afternoon. And increasingly, to suit overseas markets, games have been shifted away from that slot and played at other times over the weekend. That causes some sort of resentment from these traditional fans, because they see that as not only inconvenient, but also symbolically a way in which the club has been taken from that local community too. So there's not an outright dislike of the overseas fan groups in any way, shape or form, but it's about how the impact of that, of the overseas markets, the international markets, might remove the club from them. Mm-hmm. And also how the presence of such elements might just distance the club from those traditional fans.
Yeah. So with the new fans, you do have a chapter on fans in Scandinavia, East Asia, and the United States. Do you find, is the group in New York that pays deference to Liverpool fans, is that common? Is that unusual? How do overseas fans view themselves in relation to traditional
Club
fans?
A club like Liverpool, where probably most of my field work was connected to for this book, a club like Liverpool, it's relatively common. So, for instance, you get lots of Scandinavian fans who come over, and they want to be part of the real fan practices, and real is a code word again for these traditional fans. And so they hang around with them. They go to the same pubs. They look to talk to them. They defer to them. And so that's relatively common. With the rise of supporter groups like Spirit of Shankly, the Liverpool supporter group, and the rise of these and spread across the world, well, actually, the core values of those groups like Spirit of Shankly have been about the protection of these traditional fans and what they see to be the right thing for the club. So that deference has gone on through those processes too. So it's relatively common, yes.
So back then to the traditional fans, they would be more accepting of a Swedish or an American fan who comes over, hangs out in the pub, sits with the traditional fans, you know, is trying to get the experience, trying to learn from the traditional fans, as opposed to what someone who's working in finance in London who comes up and also tries to assimilate to the fan culture. So they'd be accepting of the American, not accepting of the affluent Londoner. Would that be
absolutely
correct?
Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. Yes. For instance, the Norwegian Liverpool fans are more readily accepted under those circumstances than the Wolves, as they call them. So people like me, mm-hmm. people who are from 30 miles away, mm-hmm. are less readily accepted than those who are from Norway in this case. Mm-hmm. But it's about perceptions of what this type of fan is like. So it's not even on an individual level. It's about a perception of the qualities that sort of fan would have and how they may fit in with their existing practices. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. All right, well, let's talk about owners and the American owners of Liverpool and Manchester United. But first, to give some background, it seemed to me while reading the book that there's been for a major sports league, there's been a surprising amount of flux in the ownership of Premier League clubs. Why has that been the case that so many teams have changed ownership?
Changed owners. I mean, I think it's in part reflecting the growing international prestige of the league over the last number of years. And because of that, the international prestige, the revenues that clubs can generate, the amount of money that's been sloshing around international markets, the ease of borrowing money, I think there's attractive offers put to existing owners or previous owners, and they've sold, you know, to the owners before English football truly went into this overseas international space. I think, these were still businessmen, business people. An attractive offer gets put to them, they sell the club. Mm-hmm.
So let's look at Manchester United and Liverpool and their American owners. Can you talk about these new owners, and what was the initial fan reaction with these two clubs to the purchase?
Quite contrasting between the two case mm-hmm. studies. At Liverpool, well, I'll start with Manchester United, because that happened first. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Glazers have been gradually buying into Man United for about 2 or 3 years before they actually purchased the majority share of the club in May 2005. And in May 2005, there was immense hostility towards the Glazer family, and that hostility hasn't really ebbed away. And the fears were there around the renaming of the stadium, the possibility of selling top players frequently, but also around placing the club into debt, leveraging the purchase price back onto the club. And some of those fears have been realised, some of them haven't actually. So there was a huge amount of fear and hostility at that point at Manchester United. And the fan groups separated. Some of them went off and formed a club themselves, FC United of Manchester, a non-league football club, which is owned by the fans, which has players paying who play for them for only a small fee. So the players continue to belong to the same communities as the fans. Some of them agreed that they would, what they call, fight from within the club, so continue to support but form certain forms of protest from within the group. And other fans, you know, gave it a let's suck it and see. They weren't too bothered at that moment in time. At Liverpool, the example is rather different. At the point at which Hicks and Gillette bought the club in 2007, the fans opened them quite readily. They welcomed them quite readily. They were really pleased that they were there. And they were really pleased that they were there because they believed that the new owners would bring investment in the team, and then within a few years they would be ready to win the Premier League again. That changed about a year afterwards. February 2008, there was the start of the first fan projects that were in opposition to that. And that was gradually through the ideas that they, like Manchester United, had the purchase price of the club leveraged back upon them, that actually much of this team investment wasn't happening as much as they would have hoped, and that the two owners weren't prepared to finance that. So there were differing views between the two clubs.
So how large were these opposition groups within the broader fan communities?
Okay, at Manchester United, FC United launched, and it launched through a public meeting in Manchester, on the edge of Manchester City Centre, which had several hundred people there. Many of those formed FC United, this supporter-run football club, and they received about 5,000 people per game for the first season. So 5,000 people who were joining together in part to protest against the Glazer ownership, in part to enjoy a kind of re-energized fan experience of being able to chant when they wanted, paying relatively smaller fees to get into the stadiums. A re-energization of that experience. That attendance has since dropped off to about 2,000 now. Mm-hmm. The fight from within Manchester United protest was harder to track in terms of numbers, but again was probably more restricted to I would suggest the small thousands again within mm-hmm. this. The majority of the fan base were fairly apathetic at that moment in time. However, at Manchester United in 2010, January 2010, the idea was launched to wear green and gold scarves to games. You may have seen this in the coverage, mm-hmm. but green and gold scarves, which were there to signify Newton Heath, the original name for Manchester United, and their original playing colours. Fans were to wear these games to show that they were opposed to lots of what the Glazer ownership had brought to the club. And that's incredibly hard to quantify, the number of fans who were involved in that type of protest. And it's also difficult to work out how many of these fans were doing this as a form of protest or a form of doing something that they thought looked quite good, yeah. was aesthetically appealing. Really hard to work that out, but those numbers were far larger. Those numbers potentially ran into the small hundred thousands. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. At Liverpool, we've got three forms of protest which emerged in 2008, 1 year after Hicks and Gillette bought the club. So we've got, as the first, we've got Share Liverpool, which was launched by Rogan Taylor, who's actually a sociologist of sport too, whose evidence we referred to early on in the interview, where he spoke about Rangers being the biggest club in Britain. And he proposed an idea that I think it was 100,000 Liverpool fans could pay £5,000 each to buy Liverpool Football Club. So that was premised on 100,000 people. Now, the actual numbers who pledged support for this, despite Rogan Taylor talking about the website going down with popular interest in the first few days, would be far, far, far fewer than that. Mm-hmm. Those numbers weren't released, but far fewer than that. At Spirit of Shankly, which was launched on more or less exactly the same night, at the very end of January 2008, Spirit of Shankly was launched in the back of a pub in Liverpool. So had 50, 100 people in the back room of a public house. So small numbers again involved there. I mean, the numbers of people who are enrolled as Spirit of Shankly members have continued to grow and are still growing now, actually. Spirit of Shankly, although at the moment they're happy with John Henry and the new ownership at Liverpool Football Club, have continued to campaign for various other things, such as the establishment of a supporters committee who have a say in the major decisions involved with the club. So that's grown gradually, but we're still talking about small thousands of people involved rather than hundreds of thousands. Mm-hmm. And the third form of protest was much like FC United, a non-league football club which Liverpool supporters set up, and this is AFC Liverpool, and that club attracted far, far fewer than FC United did, mm-hmm. and so the numbers there are quite small too. So I guess if you're asking me, percentage-wise, in terms of how many fans of Liverpool, what percentage of Liverpool or Manchester United fans took part in these protests, I can't give you a definitive answer, but I would say that it was a minority.
Yeah. So can you see any change in decision-making at the top level where the directors realized, we've got this opposition movement on our hands, we need to take some steps to... I don't know. I don't think they were making demands, but at least to placate these dissidents in our fan base.
Not really at Manchester United. At Liverpool, not really under Hicks and Gillette. But once the club was bought by John Henry and New England Sports Ventures, New England Sports Ventures were, I think, quite clever in incorporating what was the resistance into their decision-making processes, or at least giving the perception that they were becoming part of the decision-making process. So what I mean by this is, as a result of the fan movements, John Henry established a Liverpool supporters committee where supporters would be represented by a few representatives on a board who would discuss major decisions, and these would feed into future decision-making processes at Liverpool Football Club. Whether this actually happens the way in which the fans hope and believe that they will be part of this decision-making process is there to be seen. We'll see what will happen in the future. English football has a rich history of supporters. For instance, at Manchester City, this happened about 15, 20 years ago, whereby a supporter representative was invited onto the football club's board of directors. But actually, supporters, his job was less to represent the fans' opinion, but to feed back to fans in a positive way what the club's directors were actually doing. And we'll see whether the supporters committee differs from that or really just bows along with this kind of perception that the fans are actually making a difference.
Mm-hmm. So we've already talked a bit about Manchester City, but I'll ask you about fan reaction or reaction among supporters of that club to the ownership by first Thaksin Shinawat, the former Thai Prime Minister, and now Sheikh Mansour of the United Arab Emirates. So how did fans of Manchester City respond to foreign ownership of their club?
Well, Thaksin Shinawatra, we'll talk around that example first of all. Thaksin Shinawatra was greeted with a warm welcome, let's say. Some people were less welcoming than others, but generally there was no widespread resistance. They were quite happy because, again, they thought that Shinawatra, despite the numerous allegations connected to his politics that were out there, they believed that he would invest in the team and improve them. And he probably did. The team were probably better at the end. And to those fans, they spoke around. I think one of the pieces of evidence talks about football crimes, as if they're, you know, as if that should be different from crimes against humanity, as would be alleged. So these fans were generally quite warm towards Shinawatra. Sheikh Mansour, well, when he bought the club, the day he agreed to buy the club, Manchester City went into the transfer market and bought Rubinho for, I think, £32 million, a huge sum of money. And it signalled his intent to go and purchase top quality players and improve Manchester City, give them a chance of winning leagues, winning tournaments, and crucially also beating Manchester United. And so he was universally welcomed by supporters. And that universal welcome and acceptance of him, if anything, has grown in the years and months since then.
So we're almost out of time, Pete, and I want to ask a question that gets away from the book. It deals with an episode this season in the Premier League, and that is the situation surrounding Luis Suarez at Liverpool, and give the background of the scenario for people who are not familiar with it. So Liverpool is a club owned by an American, John Henry, who's also the owner of the Boston Red Sox. The squad has at least 13 players who come from outside the UK. And this past October, one of these players, Luis Suarez of Uruguay, made racially abusive statements in a match with Manchester United to Patrice Evra, a French international who's originally from Senegal. And Suarez argued in his defense that the word he used when talking to Evra is not offensive in his native Uruguay. And the Liverpool club made a strong statement in criticizing the FA's decision to give Suarez an 8-game suspension. So you have an English club, an American owner, a Uruguayan player involved in an altercation with an African player. So what does the Suarez episode tell us about the English Premier League as the global football league?
Well, you've said it. It's an example, isn't it? It's a huge example. I just find this whole situation really difficult to thoroughly analyse, and we've got to be so careful with this. I mean, to me, this whole situation just seems really, really regrettable, and it seems to have just been really poorly handled. First point I want to raise with it is that it was really horrible and unfriendly banter from both teams, from both Evra, the Manchester United player, to Suarez, and from Suarez to Evra. I think Evra said something quite unpleasant about Suarez's mother, I think, and it's horrible, unfriendly banter. And what Suarez said, Suarez claims that the word he used was quite playful in Uruguay and in Latin America. Well, I don't think he used it in a very playful way at all. I mean, I think he was quite aware that this was a way of attacking the opponent. Evra verbally attacked Suarez too. It wasn't meant to be nice. And I don't know the exact meaning of those N words in Latin America, but it wasn't meant to be nice. It wasn't meant to be good. I think another big issue with this, why it's really regrettable and difficult to analyse, is I don't know whether you're aware of this, but the is it an 8-match ban? Yeah, it's an 8-match ban. The 8-match ban was announced shortly before Christmas, 2 or 3 days before Christmas. And actually, the evidence upon which this decision was made was only released on the 31st of December. So we've got a week and a half in between there. And I think that lag just allowed so much speculation about what happened and what didn't happen to really rise to the fore. and it allowed Liverpool fans. Well, in between, Liverpool played my club, Wigan, and the fans chanted in. The Liverpool fans chanted in support of him. The players wore t-shirts supporting Suarez, and it just allowed this sort of this. Without anybody knowing or seeing the evidence, allowed a lot of conjecture to build. So I thought that was really bad too. And I just thought, I mean, I suppose my fourth point here is that I thought that Liverpool's handling of the situation was probably ill-advised and regrettable as well. And it was, I understand Dalglish wanting to support his player, and I understand the fans wanting to give some support to Suarez, especially given when the evidence wasn't known at that point. But I think that Liverpool Football Club's denial that this was wrong was ill-advised. I think at that game against us, Suarez was roundly booed and racist was chanting at him. And afterwards, Kenny Dalglish claimed that the FA should charge Wigan Athletic for failing to control their fans. I don't understand that. I couldn't possibly understand that. I thought the handling of that was wrong. And I thought the T-shirts were symbolically wrong. I thought, I understand the need for players to support their colleague, but I thought a far better thing for them to do, a far better T-shirt for them to have worn, might have been a kick racism out of football T-shirt with Suarez's name on the back, for instance. So the blending the two together. I just think that this situation is really regrettable and really unfortunate. And I think that as a result, it's lifted the lid on racism to be viewed as acceptable by some moronic elements of the fan base. And on the social media, you've got an abuse of Evra, which has emerged, where he's being called the N-word by opposing fans, which just isn't acceptable. And I spend a lot of time in the northwest of England, and in Liverpool city centre, I'd seen some graffiti using the N-word cropping up over Christmas. And I just think the way in which this has all been handled has been really unfortunate. I think it's really difficult to analyse.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So let me ask about, what do you think of Suarez's defence that in my cultural context, this word is fine? Whereas the FA saying, well, you're playing in England, and in our context, it's not fine. Can the Premier League, the Football Association, with so many players coming into the league from outside of the UK, from outside of Europe, establish some stated expectation? This is, you're playing now in England. This is what's going to be expected of you.
Well, I think youth programs in England have this sort of training, and there is talk that this training will be rolled out to players coming into England and the UK from overseas. But having made those points, Suarez, and I don't want to unnecessarily attack Suarez here. As I say, I think the situation is fairly complex. But Suarez had played in Holland for a number of years, mm-hmm. where the use of the N-word is really undesirable there. And Suarez didn't use the N-word to be friendly to Evra. He used it as a form of attack. Perhaps he didn't realise just how bad that is in the UK. But still, he used it as a form of attack. It wasn't friendly banter. It was unfriendly banter at the most generous way we can view this. Mm-hmm. He just shouldn't have done it. He shouldn't have said it. I think that's the bottom line on this.
Mm-hmm. So let me ask about John Henry's role in this. And this story, I think, unfortunately, has received no coverage in the mainstream sports media in the States, even though...
Okay.
If something like this were to happen with John Henry's American team, the Boston Red Sox, where a player on the Red Sox uses a racial slur and then is punished by Major League Baseball, but the club administration and the other Red Sox players make statements in support of the player and against the punishment set down by the league, there would be there would be fire and brimstone raining down on the Red Sox and John Henry. And yet, what has his role been? Has he taken any role or said anything in the Suarez case in England?
As far as I know, John Henry hasn't said anything on this. John Henry has remained quiet on this. And to be honest, that's probably the best thing he could have done.
Mm-hmm.
Give a dignified silence. And I would suspect that John Henry doesn't feel sufficiently comfortable in his role at Liverpool and his acceptance by those fans to be able to come out and say something that might potentially attack the club's great icon and current coach, Kenny Dalglish, and his views, if they run counter to his, which you suggest they might have done in the context of US sports, or Luis Suarez, who is currently the team's key player and probably a £50 million asset to Liverpool Football Club. Mm-hmm. So I guess he doesn't, as either for business reasons, both connected to his ownership of the club and the contract of the team star player, which is probably worth £50 million, he doesn't feel like he can risk that.
So the Suarez case shows that there is a never-ending supply of topics in researching the Premier League. So what are you working on now?
Oh, blimey. Well, actually, I'm working with a team of European researchers to look at fan projects and fan engagement projects around the running of football clubs and whether this, and this keys into, I suppose, the last point we spoke about, but whether these projects could potentially reduce or alter or reshape violence, abuse and intolerance in European football, working with a team of Czech researchers. That's going very well. And other future research, which I'm working on as well, is work around community projects in sports, so various community projects as a result of shortfalls of government spending, which is a context which is happening in the UK at this moment in time. So there's plenty of research here.
And then Monday night you're going to watch Wigan and Manchester City, correct?
That's right, yeah. Bet your house on us winning that one.
You've been listening to an interview with Peter Millward about his book, The Global Football League, Transnational Networks, Social Movements, and Sport in the New Media Age, published in 2011 by Palgrave Macmillan. New Books in Sports is part of the New Books Network, which offers dozens of podcast interviews with the authors of new publications on subjects from biography to military history. If you like what you heard here, please friend us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter, where you can offer your comments and find links to thoughtful, shorter sports writing from around the world. I'm your host, Bruce Berglund. Thanks for listening. And in case you're wondering, I should have taken Pete up on that bet. Wigan Athletic lost 1-0.